call the meeting to order. It is 8:03. And with that, I would take any public comment on non-agenda items.
Mr. Edwards, this is Kevin Germain. I'm wondering if this is where you want me to talk. Oh, wait, I see us later down. I'll be quiet. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Tom.
Yeah, you are on the agenda, so we
will get you down there further. I just saw it.
Is there anyone else who would like to entertain some public comment? Hearing none, I will go around to the board members for a declaration of any conflict of interest of things that are on the agenda. Peter?
None. Thanks, Tom.
Mike Ducadoy?
None that I can see.
Dick Fast?
Nothing. You're muted, Tom.
Guys, coming out.
All right. Am I unmuted?
You are.
Good deal.
Tom, you're muted.
Who is?
Tom Reeves.
Oh.
Bill, welcome to the meeting, and we're just going around the room asking for conflicts of interest. Do you have any? Bill, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Do you have any conflicts of interest?
Do I have any what? No, I do not.
And is Mike Wiklinski on the call?
He's just getting on right now. I'm just letting him in. He's on now.
Good morning, Mike Wiklinski. I'm just asking for any conflicts of interest of items that are on the agenda today. Mike, this is Tom Reeves. Mike Wiklinski, and we're looking for any conflicts of interest.
No conflicts.
Okay, with that, we will move on to the consent agenda. We have the minutes, the financial report for October, and the sewer and water operators report. Any comments or questions?
I move we approve.
I do have a comment, Bill, if I could just okay. Give you a minute. I was going to ask Terry, is this summer we just got through the billings for the first time since the rate increase went up. Can you give us a little feedback as to what you saw in terms of did usage go down and did how are the revenues?
Well, Tom, actually, this was our highest billing. It was the highest usage ever. And the agents that we implemented did have that. Our customers, who are big irrigators, took note of the change in irrigation rates. Calls this last quarter. So overall, hopefully we thought we were going to be going down, but as a result of and living in their houses here, this was the biggest quarter we've ever had. So
Harry, there was one other question I had is you had a chart in the financial package.
Yes.
And I'm not sure I quite understood it. And I was wondering if you could take myself and the board through it. It was a chart on, I believe, financing options and the impact.
Yeah, Tom, we'll go through that later down in the agenda. And it's just a summary of our revenues and expenses and the debt service that we expect based on the dollar value we're going to have to buy. And I'll go through that chart when we get down to old business financing. If you want to do it now?
No, let's do it when we're on that item. And so Bill Shropshire had a motion to approve the consent agenda. Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion by Bill Shropshire, second by Mike Wiklinski. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Passes unanimously. And with that, we will move on to the business action items.
All right. I did want to point out one comment I made in the financials. Normally, we have a draft audit report for the November meeting. We don't have that yet. I think it'll be in December. Terry, do you have an update on when we might see that?
Based on my discussion with our auditor last week, he will have something for our December meeting. Whether or not we'll have a final audit is still a question, but we will have something for the board to review at the December meeting.
Okay. So the first business action is the bid advertisement. There's a draft of the bid advertisement in the packet. Scott Bucher's on the call. He'll highlight that. I want to defer any action on this until we've had the opportunity to hear Scott's report. Our financing works into this bid advertising. We're looking at extending the timeframe from 60 to 90 days. And given some recent information we've gotten from the SRF program and their cash flow issues, we've had to revisit the whole financing plan for the project. We think we can get through it, but just to make sure we've got enough time, we're proposing to increase the bid advertisement period. So I'd like to move on to the COVID testing trailer matter. We've got Kevin Germain on the call. I wrote up a little bit of narrative. There's information in the board packet. I'll pull this up for the benefit of the So that's a picture of this mobile trailer. Kevin came to me maybe a week ago or so. They're working on trying to get this trailer into Big Sky to do systematic COVID testing for the whole ski season, is my understanding, worst case. And they've been looking for a place to put it. They came to us. We looked at search and rescue down there. We looked at our site up here. There's some needs that go along with this trailer. Probably the most difficult one is their power needs. They need 208 volt power, three phase, which isn't that easy to accommodate. We talked with our electricians. We can get three phase power off of the filter building. So in my report, I put a picture of where this trailer could go potentially. It's the white rectangle here. It's approximately 55 feet long by 9 feet across. There's a foam pedestal right here. Talked to Tyler Laurel, the Three Rivers manager here. That's a dead pedestal, so that could be removed. and the rocks taken out of there. So we've got enough room to park it there. We can get power to it. It needs water and sewer. We have to figure those pieces out. We've got a sewer manhole right up here between the old First Place building and Three Rivers. So we could potentially route some temporary pipe over to that manhole here. There's also one out in our paving. We're not wild about that, obviously, with snow plowing issues, all of that. I'm gonna let Kevin jump in here and explain more of the details on this. And then you can ask him questions that you all have. So Kevin, if you would take over.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Ron. So I have been stalking Ron on this, and he's been very gracious and has entertained my calls and site visits to find a spot for this trailer. The trailer itself is the laboratory that will be processing the tests. We're working on a partnership right now and hope to have the agreement signed either today or tomorrow with this company, Let's Get Checked, and also Bozeman Health. Bozeman Health would be administering or overseeing the testing of employees, essentially. And then these tests would get brought to this lab here for processing. When I say employees, that's what Bozeman Health will oversee. We are also, Resort Tax has funded in partnership with some money BBS had from CARES Act, about $1 million towards the testing program, which would pay for about 291 tests a week that would be available to community members and small businesses. And so this is a three-way partnership, if you will, with some public dollars. There's a lot of private dollars. The large employers in Big Sky have all signed up, including YC, Moonlight, Spanish Peaks, and Big Sky Resort, that will privately be paying for testing of their employees. And then we also have philanthropy dollars. The three community foundations are working on paying for the testing for the school. So we'll be testing community members, employees, as well as the school, and all these test kits will be coming to this lab to be processed. I think the major concern Ron had, rightfully so, was traffic impacts. As I mentioned, people aren't just coming to this lab. This will be a courier bringing the lab kits here to be processed. That's kind of an overview of the project. The other concerns Ron had was biohazard coming out of the wastewater. It's really just a strong detergent. Essentially, picture a dishwasher in this lab that's cleaning equipment. I sent Ron the material data sheets on it, and it looks like it's just a strong detergent, so confident there won't be a biohazard coming out of this. The lab kits itself, these are self-sample, so you swab your own nose and you put them into the kits. Once they're into kits, the virus is inert, so there's not a risk of the virus being transported to the site via the test kits. It's a community-wide program. This lab will have the capacity to do up to 1,050 tests a day. And we're probably going to be running about 700 or so tests in this lab every day. Hopefully, the schedule right now is the semi-trailer would show up, I believe, November 25th, which is the day before Thanksgiving. We would get it parked on site. And then over that weekend, we would hopefully get the water and sewer hookups and the power and fiber hookups done. And then that Monday, I believe it's the 30th, the Let's Get Checked lab team would arrive and they would validate the machines, get everything up and running. And at the best case scenario, the lab would be operational December 3rd or 4th. At the longest it would be December 7th. And I realize this is all moving really quick, but that's a quick overview of the lab and the request.
Kevin, where are the tests going to be taken? Is it individual, and is there a collection site, and then they're brought to the lab?
Yeah, Tom, that's a great question. So for the mass employee testing, the surveillance testing of employees, Bozeman Health will be going on site to the large employers and overseeing the employees administer the test to themselves so they can do like 10 people at a time. For the community members, the plan is to have just a pickup and drop off location. These tests come in a little box that you go home, you register online on their website and activates the test kit. Then you take your own sample, you box it up, and then you'll drop it off. We're still working on the pickup and drop off location, Tom, for the community, but we'll find a central site for that.
Is there a reason why the hospital has not said this is where we want the lab?
Yeah, Tom, initially this was planned to be at the hospital. Bozeman Health is concerned about the overall traffic and congestion at their hospital with the existing COVID surge that's happening in Montana. And then you combine that with the opening of ski season and their course of business, regular ski injuries. And so initially they said we could do it there. And then they came back to us and said, we're really concerned with about how much traffic we're going to have at our site. And they turned us down. And this has gone up to the CEO of Bozeman Health. And they've told us no. They have. I will say, Tom, with that, Bozeman Health has been an awesome partner in this project and working with Bergen Knopf, who's kind of their lead helping us. She's been wonderful and they've been great partners. They just don't want to have any congestion at Big Sky Medical Center. Hey,
would you make a couple of more cups of coffee, too?
Any other questions that you have for Kevin? Ron, what do you recommend?
Well, I think we can do it and accommodate it. I think it'd be a good thing for the community. Kevin touched on some of my initial concerns, traffic and biohazards. They answered those to my satisfaction.
I think something like this on the traffic side, we have to just adjust on the fly, right? I mean, just make some modifications to the plan once it gets rolling and see what chinks we have in our armor.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then the other question I had for Kevin as we got into this was whether our staff would be in the queue to take advantage of this, and we certainly would be. So there's some benefit to the district staff for this.
And I can let you guys know, we've explored so many different options. This one is the most exciting when you look at cost and speed of turnaround. Everybody here is really familiar with what's going on with the pandemic. And the ability to have a lab here on site that would turn around tests within 24 hours is a huge thing in stopping the spread. There are cheaper alternatives that would require mailing the tests off to an offsite lab that would take, it takes your turnaround from under 24 hours to 48 to 72 and sometimes longer. And so this is definitely the route we have chosen just for the quick turnaround and the accuracy of these tests.
What would the hours of operation be, Kevin?
Ron, I'm still working on that with the lab. My guess is it's going to be Monday through Friday business hours, unless we exceed their minimums of the 690 per day. If we go up to the 1,050, which is the ultimate capacity of this trailer, that may be some evening hours, but still working on it.
Okay. So I highlighted one of the requirements that Kevin had sent me with the workstation. So my thought on that is the lab area in our filter building has a big desk surface area. Two workstations could be accommodated there easily. There's a bathroom there. They would never need to come in our building, the office building, for this. Once that's fully set up, we already have internet over there, so we could get them connected to internet easily as well. Kevin met me last week to look at that space. He seemed pretty excited about its ability to meet that need.
Well, from my standpoint, it looks like a good project. So
just have a couple of questions. How long do you anticipate this remaining there?
Dick, the shortest it would be there is through the end of January. That's our minimum contract with this lab. The longest it would be there is mid-April through the entire ski season. And so I think going into this, we got to think about this being through the lab being there through mid-April.
And Kevin, you may have mentioned this. Is this a walk-in, those tests, or do they still need a doctor referral?
This will be for the community members, and Danny Birchwell is still working on the details on how we're going to prioritize and allocate the resort tax paid for testing, Dick, but likely you will not need a doctor's note. This is for asymptomatic testing. So this is for people that do not have symptoms. If people have COVID symptoms, they need to go to Bozeman Health and see their healthcare provider. This is just for asymptomatic. So you will not need a doctor, and this is self-administered.
Well, that's real handy. So if somebody wants to go visit, say kids or something, and they want to follow up or check before they go, that's great.
That's exactly it. Or if you've been around COVID cases and you're concerned, I have a feeling if we have these available, there's going to be quite the demand of people that just want to get tested for their mind.
Hey, Brian Wheeler, I'm curious what your thoughts are. Big Sky's the biggest employer we've got here. I know you guys have been probably party to some of these discussions. What's the resort thinking?
You know what, we actually looked, well, Ron, you and I talked about this on Thursday and Friday. We looked at places on the mountain as well, and of course we support it. I think it's great to have such a fast turn, especially operationally with the employees, and got 1,000 people coming on board in the next couple of weeks. Needs a swift decision and anything we can do to support it. Kevin, we looked at over by the locker rooms because of the three phase and so on. The circulation wouldn't work because our grades are over 12%. But yeah, we support 100%.
Yeah, Troy's been great to work with, Brian, as you know. He's been trying to help me find. We even looked at your golf course facilities down here in the meadow, just trying to find a good spot for it.
So there's a question from Jim, and I assume it's Jim Musket. Kevin, any idea how much water per day they will require? The water supply freezing will be an issue. Just looking ahead to see what might work.
Yeah, I don't have a great idea on the flows. My understanding is it's really minimal, Tom and Jim, that like they said, this is like running a dishwasher. So we're not seeing a huge amount of water need nor wastewater needs to this.
Well, I think you probably want more water because if you're worried about freezing of the pipe that's running over there. So
yeah, we're going to have to heat the water supply line as well as the wastewater line. So there's going to have to be heat tape and a system rigged up to make this all work, considering our climate.
Right. And then there's a question from Peter. I don't know if that's Peter Manka or someone else.
I'm guessing that's Peter Bedell, one of our guys.
Okay. Water and Sewer District uses the filter building. What type of exposure would there be?
Well, as I mentioned, the lab kits themselves, which would be processed, are going to the semi-trailer. I mentioned this earlier, that as soon as you take the test and put it in their solution and seal it, it's inert. So there's no exposure to the virus from the lab kits. The use of the filtration building there will be by their staff to go just do data entry. So they're not taking test kits into that area. They're just going in there themselves to do data entry. So the risk will be minimal.
Can I pop in here? This is Grant Burroughs.
Yep. Go ahead, Grant.
CJ came by yesterday and we looked over the site. The water there, they do have a tap over there at the back of the Three Rivers telephone building that they could tie into. It would be a short run. Sewer would be problematic in that they would have a long run to one manhole up there by Three Rivers telephone. The other one that's in our parking lot, the filter building, We can't do that because we need access to the chemical rooms on this side of the building, so we can't have pipes running across the parking lot. I suggest that they look into, since this trailer is going to be sitting right on top of 8-inch main, that they maybe put in a temporary tap for the sewer, just drop it right out of the bottom of the trailer, right down to the main. It'd be pretty simple to do. It's done all the time up here. The next question came up for the staff people. My understanding, it's this data entry. The lab in the filter building, those counters are high. It might be kind of uncomfortable. There is an office space up above. But my concern is that it's not a real conducive environment for people to be in there a long time. There is a high chlorine content to the air. I used to have my office in there. I had continual headaches. I could not keep plants alive in that office. They would die. We also looked at the basement here in the office. There is internet access down there, tables, and a bathroom down there. So if it's just two people doing data entry, that might be something they might want to look at. So I guess that's all I have to say. If anybody has any questions.
I just put up a screenshot of the sewer lines. So these are the two manholes, but we do have this sewer main that runs real close to the trailer. So that comment about putting in a temporary tap makes some sense in this area right here where the sewer crosses through there.
Well, let me touch on too. Yeah, the waste they're going to be generating, it is this from a dishwasher. I use the same thing down at my lab at the FBR building. Kevin was correct. It's just a strong detergent that's designed to clean glassware, labware. So that's not a concern. We also did talk about putting maybe in a holding tank right there at the trailer site that could be pumped out periodically. He was going to contact one of the pumping services here in the valley. So that's all I have to say on that.
Well, I think we need a motion on this. Does anybody want to make a motion on whether to approve this?
I'll move to approve.
Second. Second.
We have a motion by Bill, a second by Mike Wiklinski to approve a trailer going in the back of the water and sewer lot. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Passes unanimously.
Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for all you're doing, Kevin.
Yeah.
Pulling this off. We'll see. Great day.
We'll be in touch, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Grant.
Then we go on to old business, and I think it's Scott.
Hi, everybody. So there's my letter. It's in the packet. And as Ron alluded to earlier, the main thing we'd like to discuss is releasing this bid announcement that we've been sitting on a little bit. Kind of at Dorsey Whitney's suggestion, just they're not used to seeing bids announced before everything's locked up on the financing piece. But releasing the bid doesn't... beholden the district to awarding bids. You always have the right to not award bids if it's in your best interest. But the other thing we're doing to kind of help provide some time is putting 90 days in the contract from bid opening to bid award, so that if there are any lingering lockdowns on where the financing is going to come from and signatures, we have some time. So the draft bid announcement's there. It just has some tentative dates in there. Specifically, we want to do two pre-bid conferences. It's a big job and it's complicated, so we want to make sure people are looking at it really hard, and we want to do one of those as a remote conference that would be more about the contract and the paperwork and specs, and then follow up with an on-site tour that I could lead, and we would socially distance and wear masks and all that and keep exposure to a minimum. But I do want people to be able to get on site and look at the terrain and what's out there now and what needs to be demoed and just get a feel for it. So if you want, I can stop there and we could talk through that, Ron, or do you want me to keep going through my activities?
You can keep going through it. I just wanted to point out that January needs to be 2021. We'll fix that before it goes out.
Yep. Yeah, that's just a draft put out there so you all can see what it looks like. And once you all give us the go-ahead, we could have that out in, half a day released and to the bid exchanges and the Chronicle for advertisement. And if we can do that, we're a few weeks behind schedule at this point, nothing major. Our goal, again, was always to be one of the first big jobs out of this construction season so that we can have a contractor really breaking ground as soon as weather allows and making good progress this summer, which will be important if we are going to get this thing substantially complete in the summer of 2022. The Chronicle article indicates that we would be completely done in summer of 2022. What we're shooting for is having the contractor be substantially complete with the liquids stream processes. So the biological nutrient removal and the membrane process in that building so that we can be making water and then finish demo of other liquid stream processes that are going to be converted into solids treatment. So there will be activity there in the fall of 2022. Just keep that in mind. It's just going to be more of the solids handling and bid alternates and final completion. So if we can get this out and it's kind of important just to get it out so that contractors that have been told to expect it, see it and know it's real and it's coming and they can count on it and hopefully put a lot of eggs in this basket and come after it. Aggressively.
Hey Scott, what are we? We've had this escalation story, which is, in my opinion, been very negative. What are we doing on the bid letting to try to mitigate this concrete 20% escalator that's being like broadcast across the community? We're staring at a I know Terry's going to talk about, sources and uses of funding and stuff like that, but how are we encouraging contractors to help mitigate that? Or are we just sending it out there and hoping someone comes up with a better widget?
That's a great question, Mike. There's been times when I question whether or not we could point them to at least inquire about using a temporary setup that's either up there, like for the Bellagio, or putting their own batch plant, like at the quarry. It would be just a question of, do we want to push that so that they think about it, or do we want to leave it to their creativity to come up with that themselves and see if that pencils out? I don't know that it would. I've been told it's kind of on the fence in terms of how much concrete it is, whether or not a batch plant makes sense versus bringing it up from down here.
Yeah, you run the risk of quality control issues with the on-site plant, especially with the wastewater treatment plant. But we're talking a substantial amount of money that I don't think we have accounted for. And I don't know what the solution is for encouragement there, but it might be worthwhile to put a line in the narrative or something like that, that we are encouraging that. I mean, if some contractor can come in and validate quality control and product delivery and, provide a couple $1 million savings on this thing, it'd be a big deal to us. So.
No, it's a good idea.
In the bid proposal, are you going to have an idea how much concrete is going to be required?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got you know, our engineer takeoffs, but then that BIM 360 model now will do takeoffs as well. And it's been doing that for several years. We didn't quite trust it at first, but we've learned to that it's pretty solid. We still check it with a human being. And I don't remember, Youngworth's on the call. I don't remember, Youngworth, if you have the quantity handy, but it's, you know, in the neighborhood of 5,000 or 6,000 cubic yards. And that's, I believe, without the bid alternate. So the bid alternate that would include the concrete for phase two basin. So it's quite a bit. I mean, it's on par with what Belgrade's having to do. And you know, the concrete prices we saw there were remarkably different between the winning contractor and the second bid. So I'm not sure it's as much about the actual, I mean, it's a little bit of both. It's the raw concrete, but it's also the labor to do this, you know, formwork that's not run of the mill. But I think it's a good idea, Mike, and let me chew on a way to just wave that flag in the documents.
Okay.
Our evaluation of the bid alternatives, is that going to occur once we have the bids in? And so if we need to cut costs, we can do it at that point in time?
We can. We made the decision to award based on base bid so that we don't lock ourselves into a certain commitment on bid day to a budget and doing a certain bid alternate. So we've got a little bit more freedom in what we do beyond base bid, if anything.
Scott, just kind of brainstorming on what Mike brought up. Do we have any, again, this is contracting, which I'm not real familiar with, but is there any leverage that we would have as a big user? Anything we could, you know, like I said, leverage the bid, incentives in the bid for contractor to hold down cost?
Well, the way you would usually do that would be not in a design bid build structure. It would be what we call alternative delivery, where you might do some sharings of any cost savings identified by the contractor. And the contractor is part of the team with the owner. We could still do that. It would take changing our front ends. Wouldn't be a small thing, but it can be done. And we did, Ron and I did have a conversation with SRF about that. Not that, you know, we're going to use SRF funding for sure right now, but they've always been a hurdle to that in Montana. They're not supposed to be, and they admitted that, but they've also not handled that style of project delivery other than with transportation projects. So there are ways to get at that, Dick, but design bid build doesn't really allow for that. That's why we use the bid alternate process with design bid build to try to give flexibility on cutting costs. You know, there always can be things that you negotiate with the contractor once they're under contract. You know, you could have that conversation with them about potential credits if some work is eliminated, but there are generally limits to how much of that you do before you, you know, change the nature of the project and by the book would have bid it that way. So you can't eliminate like huge things, but, you can do some of that work with a design bid build contractor. The rule of thumb is that, you know, you're not going to get great pricing at that point on those credits because you're just eating into their profit. So if we did do completely private funding, we could change this structure to construction manager, general contractor, CMGC is the most commonly, I mean, there's a ton of acronyms for how to do this, but it would be the first water wastewater project of this size, in my knowledge, in Montana, doing it that way. And Ron and I have talked about this off and on many times of how we would, you know, like to see this eventually become the mechanism of delivering these projects in Montana. But being the first is always a little nerve-wracking. And it would slow down how we proceed from here, because typically you'd go through a pre-qualification process of contractors who are qualified to do that work with that style of delivery, and then solicit their, instead of a bid, you call it guaranteed maximum price, and evaluate your qualified contractor's guaranteed maximum price and make a selection.
Under that scenario, would it be just reaching out, kind of negotiating a fee structure with the contractor, and then requesting, you know, three bids for each scope of work or something like that, selecting the best bidder? What does that look like under that scenario if we had some private funding alternatives?
You can do it that way, Mike. That's kind of like good example would have been the new high school down here with Langless. They do a lot of that work. They don't do water wastewater work. Dick Anderson has not done this style of a large contract here. I think Sletten has done some of this, but not in Montana on the water wastewater side. Most of those Montana outfits have done it on the transportation side. But yeah, you would at that point be, you know, it's basically a format to help you partner with a contractor so that you get to see some of that process and have a little bit more control and be able to use the contractor's experience for getting some cost savings. Unfortunately, I don't, you know, we never went about this design with any idea of any fluff. You know, it's mostly bone and muscle out there. It's about the treatment quality, and these treatment plants come with a lot of more expensive ancillary processes because the air is foul, the environments are corrosive, so they're just not inexpensive. And when we are designing one like this, where we're trying to get to limited technology effluent quality, it's expensive. And there's not a lot of large cuts that could be made to that plant without reducing the quality of what you're putting out, whether it be the liquid or the biosolids. And I, like I said last month, I mean, this is a big pill to swallow. The second pill being the second phase, if you do take on more workforce housing or if you take on the canyon, that second phase is going to be much less expensive on a per gallon of treatment basis than this phase one. You know, we're changing the technology out there. We're trying to set up that site so that it's has maximum capacity usable for the future, and those have a cost associated with them.
Dot Youngworth sent me a chat message that the concrete quantities are 5,700 cubic yards for the phase one project. The second phase two basins would be another 2,500.
Well, we're talking a lot about some what ifs and how we're going to mitigate cost overruns and things like that. Let's just get this thing out to the street and see what we have. And I think us as a board, we're going to have some decisions to make as those numbers roll in and Scott produces some real evidence of cost out there in the field.
Ron, is it a requirement that we vote on this as a board?
I put the bid advertisement as an action item, so that would call for a motion to go ahead and advertise it. But I want to get everybody on the same page, given what we've learned with SRF, which we're going to get into. But I agree with Mike's comment. We need to get it out for several reasons. I'm still getting calls from contractors that are interested in bidding potentially, wondering when we're going to get out the advertisement. And then it also pins down our numbers for the project. You know, we're still running with engineers' estimates for everything. And, you know, Scott's been pretty conservative in those, but you really don't know until you to get bid numbers in.
Yeah, the last thing I'll add about that design bid build versus alternative delivery is you would typically go to alternative delivery with maybe 80% design or a 90% design. So there's still a lot of contingency in that and a lot of room to work with the contractor. We're at, you know, 100% and have been for a while, and you paid us to do that. So we've gone through the hard work to get to a final product. At this point, a lot of people would say, well, just stick with traditional design bid build now that you have that finished product and see what the market will give you.
Tom, do we want a motion to go ahead and release a bid?
Well, I think we might want to talk about what the financing issues are first and then get back to that.
Well, what obligation do we have, Scott? We send this thing to the street. We don't have to award, right?
You don't. You can basically call it off at some point if it's not coming together. You don't want to do that without trying extremely hard to lock in a financing plan and getting it awarded, because it'll hurt you. This, you know, you'll have to rebid it, and at that point, you've spooked some contractors and just signaled that, you know, it's, plus you've delayed it. And we'd probably be eaten into breaking ground in the spring at that point. So, and I, you know, I don't want to speak for Ron or Terry, and I think we have Ryan Graff on the line too. Personally, from the meetings we've had, I don't think getting the financial piece figured out is an issue. It's just, where is it going to come from? Is it SRF or is it private or is it a combo? And there's some work there for bond counsel to figure out what that looks like, but it's not, you know, if bids are as stout as, you know, we've tried to brace you for or worse, then yeah, there's going to be some pain, but it's doable. Now that I've said that, I'd like to hear, you know, Ryan and Terry and Ron's take on what, you know, we've all sat through those meetings with Dan Simmons and Anna Miller.
Well, I'm with Tom then. Let's dovetail into that. If there's risk to letting it out, reputational risk or whatever, let's figure out what Terry's come up with.
I guess I'm somewhere in the middle. This is Brian Wheeler. I was somewhere in the middle on it right now with the idea of working from cost estimates. At some point, you do have to take that leap and go into the bid. And I agree 100% that you don't want to go out and bid this thing, not award it. But boy, we had a bunch of surprises out to bid on projects in the last 6 months. In the surprises were some prices actually were better than expected and some were worse. And right now this number seems to be we want to dial in on. As long as you don't go to the well too much, I don't know why we wouldn't, if we're prepared, go out to a bid on it. The other thing is, by the way, I mean, if you don't have your bidding out in January, I think you're, you know, for some of these things, I think we're missing the boat. We're going to try to have all of our CapEx locked in after the holiday because we'll have a pretty good idea. But just a thought.
Yeah, I don't think it changes the outcome personally. I think we end up sending this thing to the street and trying to get our pricing and seeing where it comes back. But so we also have some optics with the community of how we conveyed the funding for this plant and how that was, you know, with the 1% resort tax board and things like that, rate increases. And we didn't necessarily promise no rate increases, but we definitely challenge the 1% to fund a lot of this in lieu of revenue bonds. And I just want to be sensitive to that front end story and how we're progressing through this with the community.
Yep. And you know, Mike, we're here to help with that too. If you all want us to, we have the communications group and can do some outreach on why it's a tough time to be bidding a project.
Well, let's listen to Terry's speech here and see what he's got to present to see how much risk there is on that.
Yeah, I agree that I think we want to end up voting today to release the bid, but I'd also like to hear Terry weigh in on what the financing issues are, and is there any risk to getting reasonable financing from the private industry? Because it sounds like SRF has got a problem.
That's correct. Dan Simmons just logged into the meeting as well. So we've got Terry, Ryan Graff, Dan Simmons all on the meeting now. We can get into the financing issues, which is on the agenda. I think we'll start with Terry. He put together a worksheet.
You want to share the screen? And there's been a few minor changes to the spreadsheet that's in the board packet. So I'd like to share the screen here and show what we have.
Let me do that. Okay. Okay, you should have control now.
Okay, this spreadsheet shows the net sewer revenues, and it's the analysis we go through with the financiers to make sure that we have adequate revenues to service the debt. In the 2021 budget, that first column, we've got the operating revenues directly from our budget. Initially, I thought that we would be able to use our sewer plant investment revenues towards the total sewer revenue number, but I was mistaken. As a result, I took those out. And so you've got our operating revenues, then we have the resort tax revenue, which the number there is directly the amount that we would have for that first annual debt service payment, full debt service payment. The next set of numbers are the administrative expenses. One half of the general administrative expenses is allocated to the sewer. The sewer administrative expenses, and then the third line are the sewer operations expenses, wherein we back out the depreciation expense because it's a non-cash expense and is allowed towards our net sewer revenues. So the bottom line on the first year here, the net sewer revenues are $3.4 million. Our first debt service would be based on the schedule that I've attached here, and I'll get to that in a moment, is $1.14 million, which would leave $2.278 million available, which means we're well funded. At the bottom of the first line chart, you'll see 110% of debt service coverage. That's $1.254 million for the first year, and 120% of debt coverage, which is $1.398 million. And based on this schedule, we far exceed that in year one. Now, these numbers are forecasted out to year two. In year two, we would have a full debt service payment of $2.6 million. But again, the net sewer revenues in year two are $3.4 million. As a result, we clear the hurdle for the SRF, which is 110%, which is 2.8. And in my discussions yesterday with Glacier Bancorp, the number that they look at is 120% for debt service coverage. And that would be 3.1. And again, in year two, we exceed that with our net sewer revenues. So we do have financial wherewithal at this point with the resort tax revenues. Now, where I get those resort tax revenues is I'll go to the underlying schedule that we came up with last year based on, this is based on a 3% increase in the resort tax revenue total take. And in year, this 2020 year, we expected the resort tax on 1% to pull in 2.6 million. To date, they have approximately 630,000 dollars. I talked with Danny earlier in the week, and he expected by the end of, or the numbers from the end of October to be 750,000, and at 12/31, approximately 900,000, which is 38% ahead of where they were the year before. So a 3% estimate seems reasonable based on my discussions with Danny. So the revenues should be there from the resort tax. If we go to our repayment schedule, now the total amount that the district is awarded from the resort tax is $27 million. And so if we use only the debt service amount for the $41 million that our engineers have estimated that we're going to need based on the base bid contract, it will take us out to year to the 2032 before we use all $27 million, which is a way to manage the cash flow from the resort tax and fund our project. And at this point, I would like to point out that there's the other project that the resort tax included in that 1%, which was the Canyon project. And so there was talk of throwing all the money that came in at the, from the 1% at our project immediately, but based on what the district is charged with, both the MBR plant that we have to build and working on the resort or on the Canyon project, extending that cash flow out to the 12-year point, I think is the best and safest way to manage the cash flow from that 1% and have the money available for the Canyon project that the district is tasked with doing, as well as the MBR. Now, we're kind of at the late stage now with respect to getting all our financing in order. We initially thought that the SRF was going to be able to completely fund our project. What we've learned in the last month is that that's not the case. As a result, we're going to need more time. I spoke with Glacier Bank yesterday, and the basic financing part of the package we can get done in 30 days. But with respect to the bond work that's going to need to be done by both our council and Glacier's council, we're probably looking at 90 days before our package is complete. As a result, we're going to need to use the district's funds for the first part of the project. If we go to this burn rate analysis by our engineer, we're going to need approximately $5.5 million by June 30th of 2021. Today, we've got $3.3 million plant investment money available and approximately $8 million in sewer reserves. So the district does have financing capacity to fund the project based on the engineer schedule through June 30th without having our bond money available to tap. But I fully expect that we can get it in place based on our discussions with both SRF, if they come to the table with a portion of it, and with Glacier by the end of March, which puts us in a good position for financing this project.
Terry, what would happen if the bond money was delayed? At what point in time do we run into problems with us financing the interim period?
We would run into problems after June 30th of 2021. I'm comfortable saying that we can finance it through June 30th, 2021, but no further than that.
So if we did run into problems, what would we do?
Well, like I said, we've got $3.6 million in plant investment money in the bank right now. We've got $8 million in sewer reserves. We can go through to... There's not a lot we can do. I mean, we'd have to go to a short-term funding mechanism, either through Glacier Bank and or through, there's a couple other, SRF has some short-term funding options. And I think Dan can speak to that. But that's what we'd have to go to a short-term funding mechanism, either through private funding sources or through either the SRF or rural development also has some of that. I mean, we need to be working on that today, rural development. So it does take quite a bit of time to put those packages together.
What's the total exposure if there's a scenario in which, basically the Big Sky Resort community shut down this winter season just due to COVID? And, how much money are we banking on from the resort tax that were not to come in? What is that in addition to the funding you've outlined through June 30th?
The resort tax funding, we've got it at $2.6 million this year, $2.6 million next year. If they shut down December 31st, then a bulk of that revenue will not come in. Then we're in trouble. Then we'd have to go to private financing. But based on what I'm seeing and based on what I'm reading, the health, the vaccines are in the works. They'll be done, or hopefully they'll be available for June 30th of next year. And I'm an optimist. I don't see things closing down. And I'm a skier, and I'm going to continue to ski unless the ski resort closes down. That, I think that's far-fetched. If Brian wants to make a comment on the resort's position, where the resort believes it'll be, I can't comment on what they're going to do or what they've been studying, but it all looks positive to me at this point.
I agree with you. It's unlikely to shut down, but I also want to be, have that as a, something we're thinking about on the back end. I mean, although it seems very unlikely, it's also could essentially happen. It may not be our decision locally. It may be a state decision. And I just want to be cognizant of that and make sure that we're, thinking through whether that 2.6, I think that was the number you mentioned, doesn't come into the coffers.
I think there's also something to be said, Mike, about the 3% sitting there as well. So there's resort tax guys are probably going to roll over right now, but there is a chance if we get into a bind or whatever that we could actually put an application towards a 3% if the 1% is underfunded.
Fair enough. But it's all kind of the same deal. That 3% or 1% only happens if we're open.
Yeah, it definitely happens at some level, but how much of it's spoken for, I don't know the math behind all of it.
Yeah, fair enough. I just want to think through it.
Is there any comment from Dan Simmons?
Hello, good morning. I have a number of thoughts. I'll try to keep it brief. I do think that resort tax projection or assumption is the critical wild card in the near term. And, you know, is 2 points really robust, particularly from a lender's perspective? I guess I have some concerns about it, you know, relative to the concerns that are obvious that have been raised with regard to COVID. And it's just a, you know, uncharted territory. And yeah, I agree that there will be resort taxes regardless, both the 1% and the 3%, but do you shave off, you know, an amount from that 2.6? And if so, what is that amount? I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm kind of looking at it right now as a lender might look at it. And, you know, if there's a material reduction from that 2.6, there's a hole to fill that, you know, could be significant based on the amount of that reduction. I know that at one point there were some conservative estimates of 1.7, and then SRF was working with 1.8. They kind of came up with that number, I think, by looking at historical averages and then just, you know, kind of spitballing, you know, a drop off from COVID of a certain percent, and they came up with 1.8. Now, if you go down to 1.8 relative to 2.6, you know, there's going to be some coverage issues with regard to net revenues. So that's the immediate wild card in this whole scenario. And, you know, we're just on the precipice of an unknown season. You know, if things do get worse, well, things are getting worse. I think one of the big wild cards is like, what are, you know, travel abilities and travel restrictions, you know, particularly for those key winter months. And I don't know if the resort tax district, Terry, were you able to assess whether they had any projections or kind of what were their, did they have like a range of worst case scenario, best case scenario? Have they done any sort of number games with regard to upcoming resort tax revenues?
Well, Danny did not provide that to me or give me any information about that. What I talked about with him was that we would expect at least a 3% increase over last year's. Based on what he was seeing and what he was projecting and what he shared with me, he said that was, he was comfortable with giving me a 3% increase over last year's. So, and that's where 2.6 comes in.
Okay. And just everybody recognize, you know, the pledge for the repayment of the revenue bonds will be net revenues, and there will be a contractual binding obligation to produce net revenues sufficient, if it's Glacier, it sounds like, to meet, to have net revenues that are at least 120% of maximum annual debt service. And that's kind of at the outset of the bond issue. You know, lenders aren't really keen about lending $40 million and saying, you know, gosh, you know, if we will need you to ramp this up later. They look from the date of the bond issue. So as I say, the key placeholder is the resort tax revenues in the near term. And then the other kind of question that will inevitably come up is, what happens after 2032, and what are you doing, you know, in the interim to prepare for that cliff and the drop in revenues? You know, are there, you know, I just throw this out, annual rate increases for 12 years, for example, that might get you there, or something of that nature, that we're going to have to deal with that sudden significant uptick in the, you know, in the, or I should say downtick in the amount of revenues relative to the annual debt service. So those are the two main things that I think with regard to net revenues that are facing the district. What is a reasonable amount of resort tax revenues, and how do you prepare for the absence of the resort tax revenues at the front end of the deal, as opposed to waiting for 10 years, which a lender isn't gonna allow you to do. And then there's a lot of other nuances in there, but those are the main things I would be concerned about from a net revenue standpoint.
Well, Dan, I'll address that after 12-year point. One of the things we talked about initially was a refinance of the outstanding debt at year 12 when the resort tax revenues do expire, and refinancing it through a general obligation bond. That was one scenario that staff discussed. The other is, like you said, we can run out the schedule with annual increases in sewer rates and where we'll be in year 12 with respect to the total sewer revenues. And that we can, at that point, just pay the debt service out of the sewer revenues. But again, that we didn't run those numbers that far out. But again, initially, it was a refinance to general obligation bonds. It would put it on the tax roll rather than the rates, like we've done with all our bonds in the past. So that's what
okay. I appreciate that. I don't think I was aware of that notion, but a couple of things in that is, you know, a lender probably won't bank on that, would be my guess, with regard to a refunding 12 years out. I mean, for one thing, a GO bond requires a vote, and, you know, you need to pass the election with regard to that. Maybe there isn't a big concern about that, but I think that would be a significant impediment, sort of thinking about that from a lender standpoint. And then, you know, as I say, the covenant is that the bond resolution that the district would adopt would say in the bond resolution, one of the covenants is, you know, thou shalt have net revenues that equal at least, I'm going to say 120% of maximum annual debt service. So that means you look out to the year that's the maximum annual debt service, and you need to have net revenues to meet that. You know, the resort tax revenues do create a kind of conundrum in how you think about that. Again, it's a good problem to have, but it's just getting everybody comfortable that at any point in time, you will have sufficient net revenues to meet the coverage.
Well, it sounds to me that our biggest issue is going to be this coming winter with resort tax, is that I think we're all kind of counting on that a vaccine is going to be out there and that we'll go back to some semblance of normal again for the following years. Have we considered at all about raising our PIC charges?
Well, we have the 82S, Ryan Graff, was charged with doing an analysis of our current PIC charges and potentially changing our PIC charges going forward. So yes, and I believe Ryan's on the call, and I don't know if Ron's had any other discussions with Ryan about the charges, but.
Good morning. I am here. Yes. Just a couple things on that. The main thing we were waiting for before really diving into it was understanding where this kind of final cost estimate has come in. And now that we have that, we'll begin ramping up the plant investment charge analysis to see what could pay for it and how that funding may kind of play into it. We do have to kind of point out, though, that based on bond covenants, usually PIC and Dan's on there as well, are kind of supplementary revenue that doesn't go in to the overall coverage calculations due to the nature of it. But I know there were a few questions earlier, and I think as Terry pointed out, it sounded like the interim financing, the bank could get kind of close within 30 days or so to get that set up and available. But I think to everybody's question on kind of the uncertainty, that is one reason that as Scott and Ron were kind of working on the logistics of the bid letting, right? That they did put in a kind of a January bid due date, as well as a 90-day award date. And so as I think Terry pointed out, it takes about that 90 days often to get the final bond documents in place. And so we would have firm bids as we begin working on those bond documents. And if it did kind of extend a little bit past that, you could use your full 90 days for award. And then you do have your cash on hand that could pay for those costs as well. And so I think the timeline as far as getting the funding in place and the cost the district realizes might be a little bit more extended than we had originally put together in Scott's burn rate analysis. And so from that perspective, I think there are plenty of buffers built in to really kind of nail down some of these other nuances on, you know, how are we going to meet coverage and show it with the lender and what would the lender take as appropriate collateral.
Well, at the end of the day, we really can't delay this project. So, you know, we've introduced a little bit of risk here because of COVID, but I think there's a risk for, we can't really delay the project either. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place if we want to have total 100% safety.
Yeah, I agree. There's multiple angles here, and it's kind of like the bidding of our wastewater treatment plant. It's hard to project until we actually see it play out. But this gives me a little bit of a confidence level that we're going to be able to bridge some of these scenarios.
If I could just comment from Resortex.
Go ahead, Steve.
So I've been texting back and forth with Danny while we're talking here, and he has in fact done some scenario planning. He just forwarded that to Terry, so we can look at that together and talk about it. But again, we are as concerned as you are about the unpredictability of what's going to happen during this ski season. We have been amazed at how our collections have held up so far. But, you know, tick-tock, let's see what happens once the season starts. The only thing we are authorized to do with you by contract is our collections under the 1%. And you must imagine that with what's going on, the pressures on the other 3% are quite significant. So, you know, there's a lot to figure out here, and I just thought I'd offer that comment. We'll be happy to discuss the scenarios we've looked at with Terry in more detail.
Steve, I just wanted to make a comment too, is I am well aware that we have a signed agreement that we will not go after the 3%, but sometimes situations change.
WSD360.com. So pull up Outlook.
Understand, but I mean, you're not the only game in town.
Exactly.
Yeah, my apologies. I actually forgot about that provision that we put in the agreement at the end. So, Mike, I was wrong. We're not going after the 3% if this is underfunded at 1.
This is Dick. Are there any other sources of revenue or contributions from local entities besides other community foundations? I'm thinking developers. You can take that and run with it.
Minus at the top. No.
I think Ron's trying to get that chart up.
There it is. Let me make that smaller. Gotcha. Yeah. There you go. Set it back up. Yeah.
I think we're just waiting for that chart to be put up on the screen.
We're not sharing. We're sharing. Yeah. Does it share your window with the video?
Yeah,
that is the problem. There it goes. That's it.
Yeah.
I should be right.
Is Danny on the line?
No, he's not. Maybe Steve can speak to some of this if you go back to those forecast tables. So is that, my question would be, is that on the 1% or is that on the 3%?
And I think when you look at these charts, is 2021 is their fiscal year, which runs July through June 30th. So we are in 2021 currently.
This is Dan. My guess would be that's the 3%.
Yeah, it's got to be the 3%. Otherwise, we're having a dumb conversation over the last hour.
That's right. We could all hang up.
Well, you to get the 1%, you just take a third of that number.
Correct, yeah.
Is Steve still on the line?
I'm here. I'm looking at the numbers and can't control the way you're looking at the spreadsheet, but I think, you know, looking at the numbers, Mike's right, that has to be the 3%. They're too big.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, once again, these are scenarios. There's a whole lot of you know, what happens to the ski season that nobody knows at this point.
I think we should move on. I think we continue to think about these short-term bridges. COVID's not going to be here forever. Big Sky Ski Hill and the resort's not going to be shut down for 5 years. Our projections out to 2023. We just got to continue to focus on these short-term gaps and bridge potential and release Scott to get this thing out on the market to see what the bridge might even look like, because we don't even know if we have an issue until we see those prices come back.
I agree with Mike, because I think we need to get a motion to approve the bid advertisement, and you got to keep an eye on this.
I'll make a motion that we release Scott to send our bid package out to the market and see what we get for responses.
I'll second it.
We got a motion by Mike Ducanoy, a second by Dick Fast to release the bid to the market.
Yeah.
Is there any other public comment?
Yeah.
Any conversation that from the board, or should we vote on it?
Let me come back to that question I had earlier. Have we looked at any other? Am I on?
We can hear you.
You're on, Dick.
Have we looked at any other sources of financing in the community? Other foundations, developers that might be willing to kick in a one-time or annual, something like that? Could take it and run with it. You know what I'm looking at. There's a lot of people with interest in this development continuing. Maybe they'd be putting some money into it.
I think that's a worthy idea. I don't know that we'll be successful, but I think that it would be, I think it would be something that we ought to check out. If we can't have deliver the funds, something is going to have to happen. Either we stop, slow up. I don't think the development community would enjoy any of those.
Go back to Mike's comment. I don't think we have a problem yet. I'd rather just get the bid documents out and see where the numbers come back. And if we have a problem, we'll look at alternatives to address it.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all.
I think we have a motion on the table, correct? Do we have to vote here?
Yeah, let's take a vote on this. Is because I think it's worthy looking at other sources, but the motion is on whether we release the bid proposal.
I call a question then.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Passes unanimously.
Okay, can I come back in and say I don't want to let this drop?
Yeah, I think it's a worthwhile question, Dick. I think Terry's got to maybe put together a target list of who that outreach goes to, whether it's community foundations or whatever. And I think it's just another arrow in our contingency plan for stuff that might come down the pike. That all the stuff we're exploring right now, I think that's another avenue of contingency that maybe Terry should start building a list of what ifs that include that.
It doesn't have to be a lot, a little here, a little there.
It would be hard to ask for money when we're not exactly sure we're going to need it, since the unknowns the community and how the resorts are going to run during the winter are unknown.
I'm just looking ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I agree that we should maybe start asking the question, but we can't give any numbers as to what our needs are.
Mm-hmm. Well, my question would be to Dan with respect to, you know, the the shortfall that we're all fearing is in the resort tax revenue. If we can get something to shore up or to guarantee that resort tax revenue dollar number somehow, would that be sufficient, or can that be put into the bond documents and qualify if we've got a guarantee or a guarantor that the revenues, if they come in at 1.8, we're going to come up with 800,000 and bring it up to 2.6?
This is Dan. That would be unusual in a revenue bond context. The pledge is the net revenues of the system. So there would be a covenant that, you know, net revenues would be defined as the gross revenues from operating, from rates and charges less O&M, would you would derive your net revenues. And then in this instance, we would say that the 1% also is a direct addition to the net revenues. But you would, the lender would be looking to the revenues of the system. Now, if you could somehow structure, a guaranteed cash flow as a net revenue, that would be the question. It feels like it might be kind of awkward in that it's outside of the enterprise fund as you would typically consider it in terms of the revenues. I'm not saying it would be impossible, but it would be something that would take a fair amount of structuring, I think, to get a lender comfortable with that this third-party commitment would constitute a net revenue, because you're looking at the, both under state law and under any revenue bond resolution, you're looking at the enterprise itself, meaning the system itself being self-sufficient. Now, Montana state law expressly allows the introduction of resort tax revenues as supplementing net revenues. But if you have an outside source, then I fear you may well not have what the revenue bond statutes call as a self-supporting system. So I think it could be problematic in a revenue bond context. The obvious thing from a lender's perspective would be you would have to increase the rates and charges in order to meet the coverage. And that would just be the reality of the situation.
So Dan, if the guarantor was the resort tax and the 3% revenue stream, would that be sufficient?
Well, in that sense, it's resort tax revenue. So that would fit a lot more neatly under the Montana statutes. How you would take that into account in an ongoing net revenue calculation might take a little brain damage, but if it's resort tax revenues, that's certainly helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we can't solve this today, so I think we're going to move ahead with the bid alternatives, and I think we ought to move on with the meeting to the next item, which is water system capital improvements.
Before I do that real quick, in my manager's report, I outlined three scenarios that we've talked to Dan about moving forward. The cleanest is to work with Glacier Bank here. I had a question to Dan, or raised a question about the legality of just choosing a lender and running with that to figure all this out versus option three, where we put an RFP together to get bids from competing banks or private lenders. Dan, I don't know if you're prepared to comment on that, or Dan's traveling. He's in Pennsylvania, so he's trying to vacation. I appreciate him getting on our call this morning. So.
Oh, yeah, no problem. If it's any consolation, it hasn't been a vacation at all. So I'm glad you brought that up. So just to give a backdrop here, I've been talking to Anna at the DNRC for months about this, and she's looking at her own cash flows in terms of the state revolving fund. And to cut to the chase, I just talked to her this morning and just said, Anna, like, can you do this? Are you in or are you out? And she, you know, darn near started crying and just said, I can't commit right now, given my cash flows and the amount of projects we have. So I feel like, as much as it pains me to say it, we just need to move on. And then moving on, what does that look like? Well, that could look like a number of things. One would be a direct private placement, as Ron mentions, directly with Glacier Bank without anybody else involved. I think you could do that under the statutes, which I don't have in front of me, but, you know, say that the bonds can be publicly sold or privately placed. I mean, certainly we privately place revenue bonds all the time with the state revolving fund program. To me, the bigger issue is, you know, this is a heavy lift, as I think we're all aware of. And does it make sense from a policy perspective to cast a broader net? And the way you would typically do that with a private placement with the bank is retain what's called a municipal advisor or sometimes a placement agent. And, you know, they would work with us and with A2S and with Ron in terms of putting together a terms and conditions document with regard to a solicitation and, you know, send it out to any number of banks. We've recently done that with the state of Montana as bond counsel. And, you know, the banks to whom in that situation the solicitation documents have been sent have been a number of banks in Montana and outside of Montana. A bank out of Utah most recently has been the successful bidder with regard to, you know, a private placement solicitation type document. So that's one thing I think that the board could consider, you know, and there are all sorts of MAs, financial advisors, placement agents out there you can work with. The one that's most local is B.A. Davidson out of Bozeman. And so that would be another iteration of this. And you know, the time frame for getting a solicitation document together, you know, that can be done pretty quickly. Again, we'd have this whole net revenue conundrum in the back of our heads with regard to the resort tax revenue. The third way you could do it is as an underwritten deal where the bonds are sold directly to the underwriter and then the underwriter places the bonds on the public market. So that's not uncommon in a number of contexts. It is uncommon for a water and sewer district, however, although you guys are kind of a different water and sewer district compared to most in Montana. You know, the advantage of that, and particularly right now, is the public market has really low interest rates. Whether that will hold for a long period of time, who knows? The disadvantage to it is it's a more involved transaction, and the transactional costs are higher because you have underwriter's discount. You probably have underwriter's counsel, you have bond counsel, you have disclosure counsel, you have to put together, you know, an official statement offering document that needs to comply with federal securities laws. You'll probably get a rating from a rating agency. You would have continuing disclosure obligations under MSRB requirements, et cetera. I mean, we do underwritten deals all the time. They're just more bells and whistles involved with them, definitely. So that's the kind of continuum I would see would be negotiating directly with Glacier Bank and nobody else, you know, and how does that look for $40 million? Or does, you know, do other people get upset about that or question, well, you know, why did you just, you know, ride one horse? And maybe not, maybe everyone's fine with that. The other would be a solicitation of banks. I will say a $40 million deal is a big deal for a bank. And, you know, if Glacier's willing to do that, that's great. We've done deals, you know, in that range, but on private placements, I can think of a couple deals where we had two banks, you know, and split it between Glacier and in a couple of cases, First Interstate Bank, just because it was too big a lift for that particular deal and that particular bank. But I don't want to prattle on too much, but that's kind of the general continuum, I think, to consider here. You know, and the solicitation route for banks would be, you know, essentially, I think, talking to a few people, you know, obviously the board, I think, we'd want the board's blessing, and then seeing if they could, you know, act as either MA or placement agent and put a deal together. Davidson often acts as placement agent in this context, and it's just a regulatory difference at the federal level that would allow them to be underwriter if they thought the bank deal wasn't a good deal, and they could do a better job as an underwriter.
May I add something just real quick?
Yes.
One thing I would note is if you are interested in exploring that, I think as a placement agent, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't have a fiduciary, but if you do engage DA Davidson as a municipal advisor or any municipal advisor, I'm not tying your hands to anyone, they will give you upfront kind of disclosures on what their fee is, how they would charge for a process like that. And then they are serving as a fiduciary to the board. And so they would have a legal obligation to really find the approach, given all of their daily experience doing this, that would likely be the lower cost. And sometimes that's why they do switch over to doing private placements. And so there's no guarantee that it would be necessarily a better deal than going directly to Glacier. But there are some mechanisms kind of built into the process to try and find you the best structure, given your really unique challenges with this funding scenario.
One of my worries is getting a DA Davidson or someone else is that you end up with the low interest rates we have. And I think Glacier is talking about pretty darn, they were going to match the SRF rate, I believe. That are your lower interest rate that we might be able to get through somebody helping us, is that going to pay for the fees that they charge?
So this is Dan. I need to be kind of careful about what I say because I'm not a financial advisor, but certainly anecdotally, if it doesn't take much of an interest rate reduction, if you're talking about an obligation this big, to, you know, more than make up for the fee. The one thing, and we can really go down a rabbit hole here if we want to kind of talk about all these scenarios, but the one thing that an underwritten deal allows that a typical bank, you know, private placement doesn't allow, is to sort of maximize premium on the market. So, you know, bonds that are sold publicly on the market have annual serial maturities. So there might be the 22 maturity and the 23 maturity and the 24 maturity. And those are held by different folks, you know, publicly in the market. But you would get, you know, a very low interest rate on the short end, that's the yield curve, because, you know, there's less risk involved because there's less time involved. As a general rule, that's the case. And then in today's market, folks are willing to pay more than the par amount of bonds as part of a pricing process. So the district, you know, you might have a $500,000 2022 maturity that, you know, is sold for $550,000. And then there'll be a slight increase in the yield because of that. But you would get additional money in the door such that the principal amount of the bonds is going to be less than the total amount needed to finance a project. So I think fundamentally what I'm trying to say is you can access a market in a publicly sold deal that might have some overall benefits in terms of the total borrowing cost. I think the biggest hurdle in it is it's a more involved process with more transactional costs. And to cut to the chase with regard to your question, if the interest rate is you know, slightly lower, that will make up for, you know, more than make up for the transactional costs potentially. And the premium often pays the transactional costs anyway. And typically that wouldn't be available in a bank private placement. But there are a lot of different shades in all of this. I think fundamentally, one thing the board should consider is, do we want to just go out and talk to Glacier, or do we want to cast a broader net? And if we cast a broader net, how do we go about that?
Well, based on what you just said, it sounds like getting an advisor like D.A. Davidson, at least having a conversation of what could they do for us, and what are the pluses and minuses, is a worthwhile exercise anyways, without making a formal commitment.
Yeah, I mean, if the board's okay with that, I mean, there are a number of advisors out there. So I always feel uncomfortable, like, you know, saying, well, who do we talk to, et cetera. But I will say the one that's closest to Big Sky and who kind of knows Big Sky, they were the underwriter, and Big Sky School District did two bond issues this year, one a new money deal for the new school project and the other a refunding bond. So they have a fair amount of knowledge about some of the underlying metrics at Big Sky and its current knowledge. So it might make sense. The person I'd be thinking about is, her name's Bridget Ekstrom in Bozeman. I don't know if anyone is aware of her, but it might make sense to reach out to her, or it could make sense to reach out to others too. We work with a number of different advisors.
Well, I don't think this requires a motion because we're not making any kind of commitment right now, but I say reaching out to Bridget is a good idea, as well as to talk, continuing conversations with Tim Ken at Glacier.
And I will say Davidson and Glacier, they know each other fairly well. They kind of have gotten involved in a, I think, a pretty good way in a couple of a number of deals I can think of in Montana. So they know each other.
Anything else from anyone?
So is it, just to be clear, is it okay if I reach out to Bridget just on an informal basis?
In my opinion, yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
So moving forward, I think that covers all of the financing discussion we wanted to bring to the meeting. Very quickly, before I get into the water capital improvement section, for the benefit of our audience, we successfully moved 25 trees from the treatment plant over to the
BSCO Park. Contractor did a great job, took some pictures kind of as the project was going forward. This last one, the shot looking east from the parking lot over in the park. And I think it did a great job of helping the aesthetics as we look east. Contractor told us that we got to get water to them when the frost is totally out, which puts us into May, and we can pull irrigation from the plant over to that area. But I think the project turned out great.
You even went through the BSOA. I was laughing as I heard that go through.
I'm not sure.
I had to go through to plant a tree. What a world we live in.
Purple water, Rip, Ron?
No, that would be just fresh water from the, if we pull it from the admin building down there. Moving down to the water system improvements, Mark Kinane's on the call. Mark, if you can unmute yourself. Gave a little narrative on it. Well, 7 seems to be the most promising of the wells we've drilled thus far. Zero lift and 200 gallons a minute. It's up by the propane farm, which is a great location. It's kind of out of the way. We want to move to doing a 72-hour, 3-day pump test on the well to really prove that well potential for a public well. Mark sent me a proposal for the pump test. So Mark, I'm going to turn it over to you. If you could kind of walk us through the schedule for this, the dollar amounts for the pump test are shown here.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So Potts Drilling is the contractor for it. Their fee is about $13,500. You know, it's in the contract, but the plan is to run a step rate pump test. So they're going to set a pump in the well Friday, Thanksgiving week. And then Monday, the 30th, we're going to run a step rate test. And that's about a 3 to 4 hour test, mainly to determine the rate we could run the constant rate test at. And that the constant rate test will be on the next day. And we'll run that up to 72 hours. I'll check the data and plot it out daily, like we did on the test well we ran last year on the north side of the highway. And it'll be sampled for basically all the parameters except for organics. So all the metals, radionuclides. When we drilled this well, it's cased down to 120 feet with 6-inch casing. So we're only able to set the pump down to that 120 foot level. The static is about 40 feet. So we've got a good solid 60 feet of drawdown potential and a little more if we need it. So we should be able to run this well at, you know, I'm not sure yet, but 100, 200 GPM. When drilling it, it airlifted at in excess of 250 gallons a minute. Now, in that process, you're producing water from the total depth of the well, so you've got more drawdown than we'd have in a pump. With a pump, but at the same time, there's some cases where air actually goes into the formation, suppresses yield. So we don't get a real accurate measure that way. But that's the plan for the test. So I hope we run it up near 200. There's going to be a pump that'll do a little over 200 in the well, and the 72-hour test would shut off on Friday. And we'd monitor recovery until Monday, and that would end the test. So that's where we are. The formation we're in, that was in Ron's narrative above here is the Kootenai. And interestingly, that's about the only formation we're seeing any reliable water production. You know, in the in these test holes, we just haven't seen, you know, much more out of the upper formations. So well four, mountain well four, and mountain well seven are I'm not sure what they're producing from, because they produce reasonably decent yields from shallower formation, but appears to be some sort of intrusive rock that we're not encountering in these other wells. As you know, we have gone through intrusive in the other wells, but it's basically been dry formation. So this one, you know, hopefully the aquifer extent is shown to be, you know, reliable for production. And, you know, the district will have a choice, I think, from this one is to, the well as it's built now could potentially be a production well. You know, there is advantages and reasons that we would build a production well adjacent to this one, dependent on the outcome of the test. So we'll just take it one step at a time. But that's where we're at with that. So
I don't know if I left anything out or
questions.
I have a question, Mark. Sure. Is there any seasonality to recharge rates?
It depends. In you know, deeper confined formations, generally not much, but it can surprise you. You know, I've done some work on some wells that are in excess of 2,000 feet that have seasonal fluctuations in water levels in those wells on the order of 100 plus feet. So, and in other wells at those depths, it's, you know, it's measured in a maybe 10 feet or so. But generally, you see it more in alluvial formations and deeper bedrock. But sure, you certainly can see seasonal effects.
Hold up the well map of our existing wells. So Mark referenced wells 4 and 7, which are over by Lake Condos. This is well 7 up here. Brian, how does this play with the resort being open?
Well, when you say resort being open, do you mean just having access to that site and so on?
Well, right. I don't see that there's any real conflict, given that it's not in any of your parking areas per se.
That's a core parking area right there, but that doesn't mean we can't work around a little bit. We need to come up with a plan. That will be full. That will definitely be full, and that's kind of right in the center of where it'll be. Yeah, we'll figure it out.
We're a little bit empty off to the side.
Hey, Ron, when was the last time you skied up there? If you didn't be an active lot. They're parking out at the dam and all the way up to Powder Ridge these days.
I know. I was just kidding.
No, I know. It's just so funny because this winter, you know, we added, and this is important to know for any of these spots, we added 500 spots over in that Levinsky lot, and we filled it on powder days, not necessarily weekends, but they were part of days when they're coming up from Bozeman. With the commuting and the buses this season, you're going to have probably 30% more vehicles up there. People aren't going to load 5 to a car, and the buses are going to be held to a lighter load. So the parking lots are going to be off the charts. We probably just want to work out a good plan that we can somehow quarantine that area.
Yeah, I don't, you know, we located this well right over near where there's some fill material that on the edge of the lot.
Yeah.
So it's actually a little bit more to the northwest from where that pin is shown.
Also, you know what I would get, I would just do this to solve this problem. Let's triangulate around that area with or put a box it in with a some jersey barriers.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, my biggest
have some of those up there.
You know, we're going to be using a lot of them this season. I just was on the phone yesterday on them, but let's see what we can do. work together on it. My concern isn't for snow plowing or anything like that. It'll be for the people that are parking around it to hit it. And yeah, it'll do a number on their car when they hit those barriers, no doubt.
It won't be too kind of a snow plow either if they try to push
it. I'm going to head up there right after this meeting. And we had some Jersey barriers stashed actually right to the north there on that behind those garages. But I think those are going to be in use. Let's definitely look at a way to cordon that off. That's good news, though. That's a good site. I'm assuming that, God, how tough would it be to just shift it over a little bit? I mean, the hard part is that is a buildable site.
Does the resort property go all the way to where you can kind of see that property line just to the south of the building there?
You know what? You see that to the well, first of all, it's a rectangle.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
The closer you can get to the eastern boundary, the better for us, because that is some prime parking area. Now will be a buildable area.
Yeah. What? Ideally, for the water well, you want to stay 100 feet, but, you know, we can submit for a deviation on that, but that usually requires something in exchange, which, you know, to mitigate risk, which usually can end up being disinfection. You know, another option is just the depth of well seal, but you know, you have to just apply and see how that turns out. But that anything less than 100 foot will end up with a deviation requirement.
Here's a question. Is there a problem
with that if you can?
Is there a problem with having vehicles on top of it?
Having what?
I mean, it's a parking lot. And when you say 100 feet, you're going to have vehicles over that, you know, all around that. For 4 or 5 months a year. Is that an issue?
No, I've done others where we wrote up the restrictions that could include parking. You know, we could include that. I'd have to look at that language. I would expect I think that would be an allowed use.
Okay.
Brian, is your long-term plan to use that as parking then?
Just like everything we do, and I tell the board, just yesterday, we had a corporate call and identified that site as shipping and receiving or a commissary site, literally yesterday. First time it's ever been discussed. So we just have to, we got to look at all the options. The good news is it's on the table and we have some thoughts on it. Let's just figure out how we got to do it.
Hey Mark, was there any preliminary kind of observations there, H2S or anything like that?
Oh yeah. So when we first started to produce water, it was actually right at about 130 feet. We got pretty good, strong H2S odor. I'd have to look back at the log, but it eventually disappeared because the deeper production zones basically were at greater capacity and you could no longer smell the sulfide. Mm-hmm. And then we picked it up just a little bit, not nearly as strong, right at the bottom. But then I had them pick up the tools about 100 feet. We airlifted on it from about 630. Well, that's when I did collect a water sample. I didn't get it analyzed for sulfide because we're airlifting. So it's you know, you're
right
going to impact the quality of that result, but sure. You couldn't smell any sulfide at that in that water. Mm-hmm. And we will, you know, I'll collect a sulfide sample out of this, you know, in this pump test. I don't expect to see any just from, you know, to have a much of a positive result, because it's kind of hard to measure anyway. And you can sometimes you smell it and you still get a non-detect. I don't know if you've seeing that, but
right. Yep.
You know, we'll go down to 0.01 milligram per liter in the analysis. So, but generally, you know, it didn't turn the ground red. It stayed clear. It was a nice clear discharge. So, you know, we'll see how the sampling comes out. We also, you know, I don't get a good dissolved oxygen measure when we airlift either, you know, because we're adding so much air to it. So I don't have any good measure of those types of aesthetics. The conductivity was like 450, 480. So the, you know, the TDS might be down around 300 or so. So that's not bad. It's okay. Probably a hard water, but wait, you know, we'll see.
Sure. Is there any indication that, you know, there's some relation to those Cascade wells?
I would not expect that to be the case, but we didn't measure it, and we're not set up to where we could measure it in this pump test. So this will be a single well test. We'll just have a pressure sensor in the pumping well. But I don't expect it to be, because Mountain 6 is up higher. I think it's higher in the Thermopolis shale, and it's producing out of fractured shale. Mountain 5 appears to get into the sandstone at the bottom of the Thermopolis. This is a formation overlies the Kootenai. So where we are sealed down into that basal sandstone of the Thermopolis, that's where that connection could exist. But there is, well, no, I don't know what I was going to say. There is a structure in between us, but that structure, I think 5 and 6 are actually on the same side of that structure. But I don't expect there to be anything significant.
And of the remaining wells that were drilled, which other well showed kind of the most promise, in your opinion?
The ones left to drill?
No, of the ones that were drilled.
Well, they all kind of hinge on the result we get. None of them in the drill depth of those explorations were worthy of a production well, but the well at near the tank, near the Mountain Village tank,
That's number five.
At the utility lot, the Montana Club utility lot, those both could be extended down into the Kootenai at those locations. So I don't want to get too far ahead, but if we were to find this was a good site and the aquifer had good extent, you know, you could look back at going back to those sites. You need to drill them with a different rig.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, that's one thing to hope for anyway.
Sure. All right, great. Well, thanks a lot, and fingers crossed that the production tests on this turns out well.
Finally, potentially good news.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Here, Brian, I pulled up the easement language. Structures, impervious parking areas, and other land uses may be allowed in the well control zone. So that's language we've used in easements approved by DQ for well sites.
Right.
So we still have wells 8 and 10, which were not drilled. Well, 7, depending on how this test goes, may make well 8 look promising or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fairly close.
8's going to be off the structure. You know, if you look at you can't see. I don't have the screen at all, right?
Yeah. Can you blow up 8? Just give me a little. I'm just looking at that one because, again, everything's parking these days. But be good to know where that well is on 8.
It's further up, right towards that sewer manhole. Yeah, it's kind of right in that area. Off, it's off of the parking area.
off now, of parking? Aren't you too close to sewer there?
Yeah, we're 100 foot from sewer, I believe. But the idea of that was, let's drill the test well where we won't impede the use of the lot, and we'll see what we have. And if there's a production well looks potential at that site, you know, that would be offset from that location and you know, could address that issue, you know, at that time, rather than, you know, leave this well out in the middle of that parking area. For
one thing to think about there is, we're going to have stream setback. You can see it on the southern boundary of lot 2A. Are you allowed to be in a stream corridor setback? Right down with the M.
We don't want to be within 100 feet of a stream.
All right. Well, then that doesn't work.
The other problem is there's a geologic structure that trends about north 30 east. And well 7 is actually pretty close to the hinge of that. As you get to well 8, you're now getting onto the east limb. It's an anticline. It's that same anticline we drilled up on test well number 2 last fall. So you might find well 8 is actually much deeper to the Kootenai than well 7. And, you know, my plan with these two wells was to, we didn't know exactly what the depth to the Kootenai would be. So let's drill them both, you know, let's drill one and see how it turns out, and, you know, drill the other, if it didn't turn out, drill the other. So I kind of considered well 7 and 8 to be, you know, one well potentially, but, they are, you know, depending on the formation and if you can get into it, you know, they're offset enough, you could get a well at both locations. So, you know, it's worthy to look at, but I do, you know, we might not get into the Kootenai at that site with the air drilling. You know, we might be able to go to 1,000 feet. I'm not sure what the depth will be. Hopefully it'll be less than that.
Well, did Bridger give any indication, Mark, of when they'd be back to finish up the other two wells, 8 and 10?
We didn't talk about timeline, but we've talked about as soon as there's access in the spring, you know, so they'll get, you know, as soon as that well 8, you know, both these sites, well 8 and well 10, should be freed up, I would think. What would you guess? Right early May then?
It sounds about right.
Yeah, so I would expect right around then. And, you know, we'll also have the results of this well 7 pump test, of course, soon. And if there's any plans, drilling plans related to that, you know, that can be planned and implemented in 2021 also.
Well, thank you, Mark. And we'll be anxious to hear what the pump tests show.
Ron, could you send something out when you get the results of that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, the water quality, when you run the radionuclides, that's, you're into that about 28 days, so we won't, that'll, you know, put us out into January, but the hydraulic part of it, you know, I'll have that available in the second week of December.
All right, we're on to development and subdivisions now.
We are, couple things in the board packet. Got this letter Friday, and then I got an actual signed version of the same letter on Monday from Kevin Smith. This is the one we've been working towards. Took a few months, but this is DEQ's final weigh-in on the capacity question. Probably the most noteworthy thing in it, I highlighted in yellow there, that they conclude we've got 100,000 gallons per day of capacity. We think we've got a little bit more than that, but rather than argue the point, I think we should write back and just confirm this letter. They do open the door for this to be amended based on data. They also want us to file quarterly reports, and this is what they've done in Belgrade and Four Corners. You know, with our tracking of permits anyway, this isn't a difficult thing for us. So we'll just have to send them an accounting of what gets permitted going forward. These two examples were ones Kevin sent for Belgrade and Four Corners. Ours will look a little different. So Scott Bucher, if you're still on the call, we need to write a reply to this, basically a concurrence letter. And then they are supposed to pick up the reviews that have been stalled without having the applicant resubmit, is what I've been told.
Nice work, Ron. I think this outcome kind of just is a tribute to how we're tracking things and how we're keeping track of growth and flow and stuff like that. I mean, turning the information, the volume of information that you guys turned around in 2 weeks, I don't think a lot of municipalities would have access to that type of data.
I kind of agree. It took, I think, longer than it probably should have, but we were able to work through it. Going forward, we can start writing capacity letters with some assurance that the department will actually act on those as long as we account for them. And we've got a couple in Town Center that are in the queue. We've got one amendment up in Spanish Peaks with the inn. I think John Olson's on the call. He's fully aware of that. And then Laura Seafang's on the call. I know the bank property across the street is in the process of being purchased by Low Mountain Land. So there's some interest to look at that going forward as well for potential annexation, none of which can happen without this letter. So at the end of the day, I think this is a good outcome. And rather than belabor the final number of 100,000 gallons a day, I think we should just reply back and concur and reserve the right to amend it based on data and flow conditions to the plant. Scott, I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
Yeah. So we have to we'll do a response and then we'll do a quarterly update, right?
Right.
But this, if I'm doing my math right, this is about 1,090 SFEs. And, you know, we always were looking at that SFE absorption rate over time to see if the new plant was going to come online soon enough. That 1,090, and I'll check all this math, but that would actually allow like 36 SFEs a month on average, which is higher than what you've seen. And I'm thinking maybe what we should do is, and I don't need to do this for the initial bid, but maybe we put out an addendum that allows more time for completion of the project to see if it gets us a lot better price. And then you and I, Ron, and the board can look at whether or not we have a year to give between now and it opening.
Good idea.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I think that's on point with some of the earlier comments about project costs. So I think it makes some sense.
Okay. It's there's a lot more to discuss there, but I think it's worth a bid alternate to give them essentially we'd be giving them another construction season to wrap it up.
I also put a copy of the deviation. I think I might have had this in the last packet, but this was the deviation approval that we got, which I originally thought was the document we were looking for, and then found out that wasn't. And so the letter from Kevin should end it.
Yeah, Scott, in terms of if we did add in another year for completion, how would that change our cash flow of the project?
It would only significantly change your maximum month debt service if we brought the cost of the project down significantly, so that the financing, you know, the financing dampens all those swings out quite a bit. So your point is good that, you know, unless we could, reduce the project cost, you know, probably, I mean, I don't have all this math in front of me, but, you know, for the purposes of conversation, $4 or $5 million, I wouldn't expect you'd see a big move in your maximum month debt load, which is what matters for the coverage and your concern with resort tax. But in a way, I think this works, because your concern is that resort tax is going to fall on its face because of COVID in this year. If that happens, then you're also not going to have a bunch of, 100 and 200 SFE developments coming through in the next 2 years, I would think. You'd see a slowdown in that as well. So you'd see your existing capacity at the plant kind of stretch out a little bit. So you could afford to give the contractor more time.
Well, I guess my thought was, is if you're stringing out the completion, wouldn't the contractor's cash flow be extended out as well?
Yeah. So your burn rate, that analysis would, those hills would dampen too. So you wouldn't see as big a months of billing from the contractor. But it's really your note, you know, whether your note is 30 million or 40 million or 50 million or whatever, that dictates what your maximum debt load is. Over the next 5 years. Am I right on that, Ryan and Dan?
I think Dan dropped. Ryan's still on. Oh, actually, both of them may have dropped.
Well, there's not a ton of harm in just putting that out there for the contractors to put a number on. It's more work for them, and they'll let me know that for sure. But and no promises. You know, I don't know. It may not make a huge difference, but it's worth a shot, I think.
I just put up the cost table from the last meeting. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about the 41, 42 million, which included a lot of alternates. Base bid, if we only award base bid, we're looking at a potentially a much smaller number.
Well, I think when we get to it is we're going to have to look very critically at some of these bid alternatives, whether we can truly afford this or not.
Agreed.
Hey guys, I apologize, but I got a 10:30 call I got to participate on, so I'm going to need to go.
Thanks, Mike, for being here.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. We still have quorum, so we're fine. Well, I think that's all I've got on that, unless there's other questions. But
hey, Ron. just for the board. So that deviation approval that Ron clicked on a minute ago, that just to make sure everybody understands, that's for changing your method and your amount of gallons per day per SFE for the plant design. So that's for the future. And then this letter from Kevin is about your capacity in the meantime with your existing plant. So that's the difference. And I was, you know, we were all, Ron and I were under the same impression that DEQ was suddenly just focused on the future and that deviation approval was the end of the story. But then they came back around for what felt like round 15 of, no, we're not done with you yet. We want to talk about what happens between now and 2022.
Good points. All right, down to legal. I put a copy of the scheduling order in the board packet. This was done with the court, I think, at the 28th of October. According to our counsel, it went uneventful. In fact, the judge wasn't even there, but it lays out some dates. Discovery close September, about a year from now. So this is a public document as it was filed by the court. We're gonna close the meeting later on here to talk about a settlement letter we received, and Susan Swinley should be on the meeting for that.
I would like to entertain a motion to go to executive session.
Tom, if you would please, would somebody make a finding that having a discussion about
The merits of the case in public would be detrimental to the litigation position of the district?
Hold on a minute.
Can I make that motion just as Susan said?
Brian made a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion by Brian and a second by Bill Shropshire. Any further discussion? If not, I'll call the question. All those in favor of going to executive session because the findings of or the discussion about the legal would be detrimental to be held in open meeting.
I'll second it.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
So we will wait a minute as people drop off the meeting. I've got the participant list so I can kind of monitor that. There were a few other things in the board packet which are just FYI. There's no discussion needed, no board action needed under new business. Permitting was actually slow for a change for a month. The development I talked about was the Pinnacle, which is up by our booster station up in Cascade. These old foundations have been sitting there since about 2007. Looks like that project is gonna go forward. Brian, I don't know if you know anything more about that, but we're seeing that's probably gonna start. Can you all see the participant list there on the screen?
I can.
Can you? Okay.
Can you disconnect some of those people, Ron? Anybody who's not on the board and Susan should be in this meeting, but other than that,
correct.
I can remove them. People are dropping off, so I'll just let them do that. You're 599-0333, right, Susan?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, Ron, that's me.
Yeah.
I was on the.
Oh, sorry. I don't know what my phone is.
But, I hear you fine. I'm not sure, but you're coming through just fine. I think Peter, is that? That might be our Peter. You're just in there once, right, Peter
Manka? Yeah. Yeah, I should be.
I think your staff needs to go off.
The there we go.
As well,
yeah, we got.
And SS is.
That's me. SS is me.
Okay. Susan. Yes. Got it.
Someday I'll figure out how to hook the non-connected computer to the Zoom meetings to get the passwords in. Otherwise, I get to watch you and by on the phone, which is okay with me.
Okay, so we're going to accept the general public again, and I'll ask for any public comment, and then we will go to the next meeting date and adjourn.
Well, there is no public, so.
Correct. Emily O'Connor was trying to log in as we were in closed session. I texted her. She was trying to get in just for the metering discussion, and I told her we were in closed session. So.
Tom, you're on mute.
The metering, is there any discussion on that?
No, it was just an FYI report. We're still shooting to have it up and running beginning of 2021. We've had some small bumps in the road, just getting all this integration to work across three different platforms. We're getting there, but it's taking a little more time. The rest of the stuff under new business is all just FYI, no comment really needed.
Okay, so the next regular meeting is Tuesday, December 17th.
Does that work? It always gets tricky going into December. I think most people are kind of hunkered down, but that would be our.
I think the Tuesday is the Tuesday, December 17th. It's got to be the 15th.
Yeah, it's the 15th.
Oh, you are right. You're right.
Okay, change that to December 15th. I'm in quarantine till April.
Nice try.
Even my I'm down all masked up next time. I am having the worst reception. It's not your situation, Ron. It's happening with a bunch of our meetings now.
From my standpoint, everything has worked pretty well. I've heard everybody pretty clearly. I think the sound quality is those issues we have. We've worked through, and it seems better to me. We are hearing you okay, but maybe you're having trouble hearing us.
You know, the difference is when I turn, and we're seeing this every day, if you turn your camera off, number one, you get the audio much better. If you have your camera on, that's when it starts kind of blanking out. The other thing is if the others, when they're not speaking, put it on mute, I think it saves you a lot of headache.
And everybody's getting better at that. Now, a lot of it's just people are more used to it. So, Brian, are you using your computer audio, or did you call in with your cell phone?
No, I'm using my computer audio, but I had to just reboot once. But it's nothing to do with your system, because it's happened all the way across Boyne. Taylor and I are across the street from each other on a call. And both of us will drop out.
Brian, I think Boyne needs to pay for a little more bandwidth.
Yeah, you know, we're on a tight leash these days, guys. Every dollar counts.
You're using Microsoft Teams as well, which is a different platform.
Yeah. No, it went well, though. I think it's working well.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with the way it worked today.
I had no problems whatsoever, other than I'm unmuting by just holding down the space bar. And so as soon as I let go of the space bar, it's on mute again.
Your visual was great, Tom, as well. Yours was the cleanest for me of any of them. So
I've got a ton of bandwidth.
It's working.
Well, you don't work.
That's handy with the space key, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. I guess we're adjourned. We'll see you next month.